intelligence estimates that questioned whether bombing North Vietnam would persuade Hanoi to end the insurgency, asked his former senatorial assistant, Thomas Hughes, to brief him on the current situation in Vietnam. On February 1st, Hughes, then director of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, carried the latest CIA and special national intelligence estimates with him to meet Humphrey, who was vacationing in Georgia. When the vice president returned to Washington, he forwarded a memo to LBJ, saying that he would support any presidential decision on Vietnam, but felt obligated to apprise the president of his growing concern about the deepening U.S. involvement in the war. He observed that the Truman and Eisenhower administrations had not been able to sustain public support during the Korean War, and argued that the situation in Vietnam was fraught with even greater difficulties. He told Johnson that there was little hope for success, and warned, as Ball had earlier, that the United States would become the prisoner of events in Vietnam. He suggested, as Senator Russell had in November, that the president's landslide victory had put the administration in a stronger position to distance the United States from the war than any administration in this century. Humphrey added that pulling out of Vietnam would present minimal political risk to the administration, and warned that, on the contrary, a slow escalation of American involvement would lead to considerable political opposition. Johnson responded by excluding Humphrey from further deliberations on Vietnam. Johnson's other advisors considered Humphrey's treatment an object lesson. Ball later recalled that, faced with a unanimous view among the president's top advisors, he saw no option but to go along. Although Ball would attempt to postpone and minimize the scope and intensity of the bombing, he would no longer question the general direction of the policy or the assumptions that underlay it. He and others had come to the paradoxical conclusion that to protect their influence with the president, they had to spare him their most deeply held doubts. If they voiced their reservations, they would join Humphrey in exile. Chapter 12, A Quicksand of Lies, March to April, 1965. The Constitution assigns to Congress the right to declare war. How can Congress discharge this function if its members and the citizens who have elected them are precluded from discussing the merits of the issues that might lead to war? The Constitution implies that Congress has a choice in the matter of war. How can it make that choice if neither it nor the people it represents have the right to debate the issues? To say that the most momentous issues a nation must face cannot be openly and critically discussed is really tantamount to saying that democratic debate and decision do not apply to the questions of life and death, and that, as far as they are concerned, the people have given carte blanche to one man. Not only is this position at odds with the principles of democracy, but it also removes a very important corrective for governmental misjudgment. Hans Morgenthau, April 3, 1965. The movement toward war seems, in retrospect, to have been inexorable, largely because LBJ succeeded in minimizing the participation of Congress in his decisions that escalated American military involvement in Vietnam. McNamara, reflecting on the decisions of the spring and early summer of 1965, recalled that we were sinking into the quicksand. It was, however, a quicksand of his and the president's making, a quicksand of lies. The support of the Joint Chiefs of Staff would prove crucial to LBJ's and McNamara's efforts to conceal the changed nature of American involvement in Vietnam. On March 1st, the New York Times reported that Johnson had begun a continuing but limited air war against North Vietnam to force a negotiated settlement on honorable terms. On March 2nd, the day after Taylor received permission from the Saigon government to land Marines at Da Nang, reporter Sulk quoted administration officials revealing the president's decision to deploy a 1,200-man Marine battalion landing team. The article reported that the Marines would be assigned to guard air bases and other installations in areas where Viet Cong guerrillas are particularly active, but would not be sent into combat. The stories incensed Johnson. He issued a strong rebuke to the military through McNamara, who sent a message directly to General Westmoreland, describing the leaks to the press as irresponsible, if not insubordinate. McNamara was taking action to prevent similar occurrences in the future, including the application of severe disciplinary penalties, and he asked Westmoreland to do the same in Saigon. The president called the Army Chief of Staff to the White House to express his dissatisfaction with the leaks and to charge General Johnson with reassessing the situation in Vietnam. Joining the general and the president were Rusk, McNamara, and McNaughton. LBJ indicated that he was willing to look with favor on a recommendation for the deployment of more U.S. ground combat units to Vietnam. Like McGeorge Bundy's trip in February, Harold Johnson's visit to South Vietnam would legitimize a military action for which strong sentiment already existed among the president and his closest advisors. His trip would give the JCS a sense of participation in the policy process. Over breakfast at the White House, the president told General Johnson to return with recommendations that would boost the counterinsurgency effort in South Vietnam without drawing public attention to the escalation of the war. LBJ made it clear to the general that his domestic political concerns would not permit a large-scale troop deployment. The president suggested that, after the 1st Marine Battalion landed, the next increment of troops consist of two Army rather than Marine Corps battalions, thinking that the deployment of Army units would blur the distinction between combat formations and advisors already in Vietnam and produce a lower noise level. After breakfast, the general joined LBJ on the elevator. As Harold Johnson was about to part company with his commander-in-chief, the president leaned down, pushed his forefinger into the general's chest, and said, "Get things bubbling." Johnson's instructions included 28 possible actions to discuss with Westmoreland, Taylor, and their staffs on arrival in Saigon. Although the president had initially directed the general to consider the possibility of deploying ground forces, LBJ ordered that passage deleted from the general's written instructions. General Johnson's team consisted of 11 men, including McNaughton and Lieutenant General Goodpaster. Because Johnson's visit was so short and its focus so broad, he did not have time, actually, to reassess the situation there, but only to compile more actions to take inside and outside South Vietnam. Johnson was inundated with information from various agencies that briefed him on more than 60 topics. After only 4 days in Saigon, he was already saturated with information. He committed only one full day to visits with U.S. advisors and South Vietnamese officials in the field. He stopped at 8 locations in that short period and had only 30 minutes per stop, which left little time for more than introductions and brief chats. Johnson found Taylor and Westmoreland pessimistic about the prospects for improvement in the situation, but fully committed to additional U.S. action. Although Taylor acknowledged the extreme dedication of the Viet Cong to their cause and the apathy among the South Vietnamese, he focused on the infiltration problem and urged an intensification of barrel roll and Rolling Thunder air operations in Laos and against North Vietnam. He continued to resist further troop deployments, but conceded that U.S. combat units might be needed eventually to offset shortages in the South Vietnamese Army. Johnson found Westmoreland more receptive than Taylor to the introduction of more troops into South Vietnam. At the end of a long day of briefings, Johnson asked everyone to leave the room except the generals. He then told them that President Johnson was not convinced that air power alone could reverse the downward trend in South Vietnam. "I am here as a representative of the President of the United States, who was making the momentous decision to commit American ground combat units on a large scale to South Vietnam." Westmoreland believed that defeat in Vietnam was imminent and recommended to General Johnson that the U.S. take whatever actions are necessary, including the deployment of additional ground combat units, to postpone indefinitely the day of collapse. The Army staff had already accomplished some planning of its own. Harold Johnson had long believed that the deployment of ground troops to Southeast Asia should precede any airstrikes against the North. He wanted well-equipped and well-trained Army units ready to fight if the situation continued to deteriorate in South Vietnam. In February, Johnson had sent his operations deputy, Lieutenant General Palmer, to South Vietnam. Palmer had found the South Vietnamese Army inept, poorly led, and incapable of fighting effectively against the Viet Cong, and told Johnson that the United States had two choices: withdraw or direct intervention on the ground. The Army staff had concluded then that a 5-division force would be necessary. One division would occupy the Central Highlands and also establish secure enclaves on the coast, while the other 4, 3 U.S. and 1 South Korean, would interdict the main infiltration route, the Ho Chi Minh Trail, from positions in Laos and along the demilitarized zone in South Vietnam. Johnson's trip to Vietnam confirmed Palmer's findings. In the northern half of South Vietnam, the Viet Cong had cut almost all of the transportation routes, limiting government control to the major cities. In Con Tum province, government forces had abandoned several districts completely. The only means of supply into the high plateau was by air. In short, the South Vietnamese government controlled only a small part of the population, concentrated in the coastal urban centers. In addition to almost routine accounts of the Army of the Republic of Vietnam defeats at the hands of the Viet Cong, Westmoreland reported that North Vietnamese regular army regiments had infiltrated into the Central Highlands and were preparing for a large-scale offensive. On his return to Washington, General Johnson reported that U.S. ground forces would have to intervene directly in the counterinsurgency. Although the general remained a private critic of the air campaign, he argued that the slow tempo and self-imposed restrictions on the bombing of North Vietnam had severely reduced its effectiveness and made the successful execution of 4 Rolling Thunder missions per week virtually impossible. He submitted a list of 21 recommendations that included requests for an elimination of Washington's control over targeting and munitions, the deployment of additional helicopter companies, the construction of airfields, and an intensification of covert operations against North Vietnam. Johnson based his list of actions on McNaughton's memo and on discussions with General Westmoreland and Ambassador Taylor. Johnson provided no strategic concept, however, to lend coherence to his list of actions, and his report did not demonstrate how those actions would resolve what Taylor identified as the central difficulty in Vietnam: popular apathy and no popular commitment to the South Vietnamese government. The general warned LBJ that temporizing or expedient measures will not suffice, but all the suggestions that he offered the president were expedients aimed at averting immediate disaster in Vietnam. Although Johnson had predicted in December that it would take 5 years and 500,000 troops to win in Vietnam, he also agreed with Westmoreland's appraisal that the United States should take whatever actions are necessary to buy time. Once the impending disaster in Vietnam was averted, the general and his colleagues could press for further deployments. Westmoreland had shared with Johnson his observation that the president's policy had evolved into one of gradually and incrementally intensifying the war. He suggested that the military support LBJ's policy as long as the president remained committed to do whatever is necessary militarily to prevent defeat. General Johnson agreed. Instead of recommending that the president deploy 5 divisions, the level of force he and army planners felt was necessary to achieve a free and independent South Vietnam, he made the politically feasible recommendation for 1 division, as long as the others were added later. Years afterward, he regretted that he did not push for the deployment of the 4-division anti-infiltration force. Johnson's colleagues on the JCS were anxious to take full advantage of any opportunity to intensify the military effort. While General Johnson was in Vietnam, the JCS submitted separate memoranda urging approval for hot pursuit of the Viet Cong across the Cambodian border and a relaxation of restrictions on Farmgate, Op Plan 34A activities, and U.S. airstrikes within South Vietnam. The chiefs thus attempted to remove gradually the barriers to more resolute military action. They pursued that course without thinking about how, collectively, those actions fit together to accomplish their objective, for they had already accepted working within the flawed strategy of graduated pressure, which discouraged such considerations. By the time Johnson and his team returned to Washington on March 12th, the president had already discussed the introduction of additional ground forces with his civilian advisors. On March 5th, McGeorge Bundy, McNamara, and Rusk met to consider contingencies in the event of a sharp deterioration in the situation in Vietnam. After the meeting, in a personal and sensitive memorandum, Bundy felt it necessary to assure the president that he and his colleagues had not generated any paperwork and that the discussions had been closed to everyone but the 3 of us and 1 subordinate each. On March 9th, as the Marines landed at Da Nang, McNaughton returned early from the trip to South Vietnam and reported to Bundy that the situation there was troubled and the prognosis grim. He suggested that the president consider sending lots of troops to prevent the collapse of South Vietnam. Bundy invited McNaughton to join him, McNamara, Rusk, and the president for that day's Tuesday lunch, at which the former law professor gave the president the same assessment. On March 10th, during a meeting at Camp David with McGeorge Bundy, McNamara, and Rusk, LBJ concluded that to withdraw from Vietnam would be the equivalent of British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain's appeasement of Hitler at Munich in 1938, resolving that, come hell or high water, we're going to stay there. McGeorge Bundy recalled that the president had decided to do whatever he had to do, but he had not decided how much he had to do. 2 days later, General Johnson and his team returned from Vietnam. On March 15th, the president called the JCS to the White House for consultation. Although he continued to delay approval for the deployment of additional ground forces, he talked tough and convinced the Joint Chiefs that he was committed to taking any action necessary to preserve South Vietnam. Even as he postponed his decision on ground troops, LBJ made concessions to the chiefs in other areas and held out the promise of more decisive military action in the future. The president loosened controls on Rolling Thunder, approved most of the actions contained in Harold Johnson's report, and charged the chiefs with finding ways to improve the military situation in the South. He ended the meeting with a pep talk. He told his military officers that he wanted them to employ any means necessary to kill more Viet Cong. He expected a weekly report totaling the Viet Cong dead. The meeting did nothing to clarify U.S. objectives in South Vietnam or determine what level of military force would ultimately be required to meet those objectives. The president's tough talk, however, galvanized the chiefs and convinced Wheeler that his commander-in-chief was committed to do everything possible to better our situation in Vietnam. When the chiefs endeavored to carry out the president's instructions, inter-service differences over how to fight the war in Vietnam resurfaced. General Greene put forward a plan for the establishment of 6 beachheads, similar to his proposal of February 1964. The commandant's plan would guarantee Marine participation in Vietnam in large numbers. Greene had suspected the Army of trying to minimize the Marines' role in Vietnam. His concept emphasized securing logistical bases adjacent to the sea from which U.S. forces could strike inland. Wheeler set the joint staff to work on a proposal that would deploy the remainder of the Marine Expeditionary Force to Da Nang and place 1 U.S. and 1 South Korean Army division in the Central Highlands to take an active role in counterinsurgency operations. Air Force Chief of Staff McConnell was opposed to both Wheeler's and Greene's proposals and continued to argue that airstrikes against North Vietnam would be decisive only if the bombing restrictions were lifted. To carry out his unrestricted air campaign, McConnell proposed accelerating the deployment of 4 additional squadrons to Southeast Asia. Instead of recommending more troops, McConnell contended that the JCS should urge immediate and more forceful application of air power against the source of Democratic Republic of Vietnam strength. He envisioned intensified bombing within the South to destroy Viet Cong concentrations, while more Air Force and Navy jets pounded vulnerable resources of the enemy in the North. Under McConnell's plan, Marine Corps and Army units would guard air bases and logistical facilities and aid the South Vietnamese Army's counterinsurgency efforts. Although the Joint Chiefs had concealed their differences from the Secretary of Defense and the President, they failed, as usual, to reconcile any of the disagreements because of their inability to overcome service parochialism. While the chiefs were divided, McNamara retained the initiative in planning the air war against North Vietnam. As a result of the chiefs delaying, and without their prior approval, the joint staff briefed McNamara on a 12-week program of military activities. It called for a 3-week interdiction campaign south of the 20th parallel, followed by a more comprehensive bombing program against the transportation network and radar facilities throughout North Vietnam. McNamara and the Air Force had begun Rolling Thunder as a campaign of strategic persuasion aimed at coercing North Vietnam to end its support for the insurgency in the South. The Joint Staff proposal marked a shift from that strategic objective to the tactical mission of interdicting the flow of supplies to the Vietnamese communist forces in South Vietnam. The chief's confusion about the objectives and scope of the bombing persisted. On March 27th, all that Wheeler could do was to tell McNamara that the JCS was continuing to study alternatives. In mid-April, the JCS, still unable to reach agreement, referred the matter back to their staff. Meanwhile, sharp restrictions on the air campaign continued. The president's exhortation to kill more Viet Cong was aimed more at appeasing the chiefs than reflective of a genuine willingness to remove constraints on military activity. Although Rolling Thunder 7, the first strikes following General Johnson's report, lacked specific restrictions, such as Washington's approval to attack alternate fixed targets, the president imposed more general constraints that negated those changes. LBJ directed that the JCS avoid air operations in North Vietnam that might lead to clashes with North Vietnam's MiG fighters. That general restriction obliged General Wheeler to limit air operations to the area of North Vietnam south of the 20th parallel. Reconnaissance aircraft and fighter escorts could operate between the 19th and 20th parallels, but had to withdraw immediately upon detecting MiG fighters. The contradiction between the president's tough talk in the meeting with the JCS and the continuation of restrictions on the use of force confused General Green. After their meeting with the president on March 15th, Green told his JCS colleagues that the Marine Force at Da Nang was ready to commence offensive killing operations within 24 hours. On Friday, March 19th, Green noted that the president had wanted a report on what measures had been taken to kill more Viet Cong and could not understand why no orders had gone out to satisfy his desire. The other chiefs shared Green's confusion and, on the same day, decided to press Johnson to deploy additional ground forces and expand the mission of those forces to include offensive operations. Under the JCS proposal, the first additional units to deploy would be the remainder of the 3rd Marine Expeditionary Force, or MEF, totaling 39,000 Marines. In addition, the chiefs urged the approval of Harold Johnson's fallback proposal for the deployment of one U.S. Army division, 26,000 troops, to the Central Plateau area for offensive operations and the deployment of the South Korean, or ROC, division of 21,000 troops. McConnell, who had opposed Army deployments, agreed to support the memorandum in exchange for a Joint Chiefs of Staff recommendation that the president intensify the air war against North Vietnam and approve the deployment of 9 more Air Force squadrons. Without ground forces along the demilitarized zone and in Laos, the Air Force would thus retain primary responsibility for the interdiction effort. As they had in the past, the chiefs sought an expansion of the war effort while suppressing doubts about the effectiveness of those intermediate steps. The justification was short-term. Wheeler warned McNamara that this direct military action was essential if defeat was to be avoided. Ambassador Taylor, however, continued to oppose Westmoreland's and the chief's proposals for expanding the numbers and broadening the mission of ground combat units in Vietnam. Wheeler pressed Westmoreland to request additional troops without regard for preserving the past policy of advising the South Vietnamese. But the MACV commander had to move cautiously, for he and Taylor had clashed when the 1st Marines landed in Da Nang. At that time, Taylor reminded Westmoreland that he was in charge of the military effort in Vietnam. Westmoreland, therefore, had to limit his recommendations for the time being to whatever forces Taylor would allow. On March 18th, Westmoreland persuaded Taylor to endorse a request for a 3rd Marine Battalion. Taylor gave in to Westmoreland's request in the hope that the battalion would comprise the final American troop deployment. As Westmoreland sent his request to the JCS, Taylor cabled Rusk, emphasizing the numerous disadvantages of sending additional forces to South Vietnam. He warned of greater losses and an increase in American vulnerability to communist propaganda and third world criticism, as we appear to assume the old French role of alien colonizer and conqueror. He conceded that the introduction of an army division would make some contribution to the war effort, but warned that U.S. forces would encourage the South Vietnamese to pass the Viet Cong burden to the U.S. He argued that there were problems with each of the locations where ground troops might deploy. The introduction of an American division to the Central Highlands, an area controlled by the Viet Cong, permits one to entertain the possibility of a kind of Dien Bien Phu. A coastal enclave mission would involve U.S. troops in an inglorious static defense mission, unappealing to them and unimpressive in the eyes of the Vietnamese. U.S. troops operating in major population areas would maximize the possible points of friction with the people. Westmoreland, however, was more concerned about recent battlefield defeats inflicted on the South Vietnamese Army than impressed by Taylor's arguments against the deployment of U.S. troops. Wheeler and Westmoreland began to work together to overcome the ambassador's opposition to ground combat troops. As the chiefs recommended to McNamara that the remainder of the 3rd Marine Expeditionary Force, one U.S. Army division, and one Republic of Korea division deployed to South Vietnam with the mission of conducting counterinsurgency combat operations, Wheeler solicited from Westmoreland and Sharp their estimates of the logistical requirements and command arrangements necessary to implement the proposal. Wheeler requested that Westmoreland and Sharp keep the JCS proposal secret and limit planning actions to the smallest possible U.S. military, repeat, military group, until he had an opportunity to press his recommendations with the president. Meanwhile, Johnson's closest civilian advisors had become convinced that the introduction of U.S. ground forces to Vietnam was necessary and sought to portray Taylor's views as emotional and illogical. As early as March 6th, McGeorge Bundy, who advocated the introduction of ground forces to improve the U.S. bargaining position in Vietnam, recommended to the president that Taylor be replaced no later than June 1st. Bundy noted that although Taylor's prestige had been instrumental in keeping American opinion from division and criticism, the ambassador had become rigid, remote, and sometimes abrupt. Bundy thought that Taylor's deputy, Alexis Johnson, would be the best replacement and that a younger man, such as McNaughton, would be an ideal choice for deputy ambassador. In a thinly veiled criticism of Taylor's performance, McGeorge Bundy told the president that what the United States needed was an ambassador who understood the essentially political nature of the problem and applied himself to decentralized action with U.S. advice, assistance, and support at every level. Until Taylor's one-year tenure was up, however, the president felt he needed the ambassador's support to preserve the delicate consensus behind his Vietnam policy. Moreover, Taylor would have to gain South Vietnamese approval for U.S. ground troop deployments. As he contemplated candidates to succeed Taylor, Johnson asked the ambassador to return to Washington at the end of March for another round of interdepartmental consultations on Vietnam. On March 29th, Taylor joined McNamara and the JCS for a meeting at the Pentagon. The ambassador and the chiefs disagreed about how many U.S. troops should be deployed to Vietnam and how those troops ought to be used. In an estimate of the situation sent to Washington in advance of Taylor's arrival, Westmoreland supported Wheeler's proposals to change the mission of American forces from maintaining security in the South to conducting active counterinsurgency operations and to introduce a 3-division force to secure coastal areas and fight communist forces in the Central Highlands region. Taylor, however, remained opposed to additional ground forces. He thought that a 3-division force was too large and argued that the South Vietnamese government did not think that U.S. troops were necessary. Taylor again warned that U.S. troops would trigger latent anti-American sentiments among many South Vietnamese. If additional forces did deploy to South Vietnam, Taylor argued that their mission ought to be carefully circumscribed. He recommended that U.S. troops occupy secure enclaves along the coast and in the highlands, leave the preponderance of the fighting to the South Vietnamese, and conduct offensive operations only as a mobile reserve force. Harold Johnson disagreed with Taylor, observing that poor intelligence would result in quick reaction strikes falling on air rather than on the Viet Cong. General Johnson, countering the ambassador's proposal, suggested that U.S. ground forces establish model pacification programs in the 3 plateau provinces northwest of Saigon to provide security, undertake political reforms, and enhance economic development. Taylor's meeting with the JCS resolved little. Although McNamara believed that some U.S. troops were needed he agreed with Taylor's assessment that three divisions seemed high. McNamara, who still wished to control carefully each incremental increase in the use of force in Vietnam, recommended that only two additional Marine battalions deploy to redress the adverse force ratios between the Viet Cong and the South Vietnamese armed forces. He suggested that if the situation required more troops, an additional brigade or division could follow the Marines at a later date. McNamara thought that the primary contribution of ground forces would be to signal resolve to Hanoi and gave his tentative endorsement to Taylor's enclave concept. Taylor and McNamara together overruled the chief's call for an intensification of Rolling Thunder. Taylor argued that the latest airstrikes had established a good tempo to forestall opposition from the JCS. McNamara held out the promise of future action. The defense secretary suggested that in 4 to 12 weeks, the mining of Haiphong Harbor and other actions that the chiefs had previously recommended might become politically feasible. McNamara assured the chiefs that if they supported restrictions on the air campaign in the short term, they would eventually be permitted to place very strong pressure on North Vietnam. Despite LBJ's efforts to minimize his recent decisions to intensify and widen the U.S. effort in Vietnam, public and congressional opposition to his policy had increased in March. Discontent over the president's policy was growing principally on college campuses and among liberal intellectuals. A State Department white paper designed to prove North Vietnamese complicity in the insurgency in the South was weak in its argument and short on evidence, the bulk of which remained classified. A week prior to Taylor's arrival in Washington, the students and faculty at the University of Michigan held the first Vietnam War teach-in to voice opposition to the president's policy. In response to the growing opposition, LBJ redoubled his effort to prevent leaks and to conceal deepening American involvement in the war. The president denied that his policy had changed significantly since his election in November. On April 1st, an hour before he met with his advisors on Vietnam, he held an impromptu press conference in the White House Theater. Johnson emphasized progress in getting Great Society legislation through Congress. When asked specifically about his Vietnam policy, he highlighted continuity with previous administrations, claiming that he was simply honoring the commitment to the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, or CETO, that Eisenhower and Congress had made. Johnson cited the Gulf of Tonkin resolution as evidence of congressional support for his policy and stated that he knew of no division in the American government over Vietnam. To dispel reports that he was discussing major military decisions during Taylor's visit, he denied knowledge of any far-reaching strategy that is being suggested or promulgated. He said that those who publicly opposed his Vietnam policy and journalists who speculated about it disregarded our soldiers who were dying in Vietnam. Immediately after the press conference, the president joined McCone, Rusk, McNamara, Wheeler, McNaughton, Taylor, and the Bundy brothers for consultation on Vietnam. Johnson made it clear at the outset that the meeting was off the record and that no great decisions would be reached. Rusk and CIA Director McCone expressed doubts about the effectiveness of the airstrikes against the North and suggested that North Vietnamese leaders, even if they were so inclined, would not be able to call off the insurgency in the South. The president seemed frustrated, wondering how he could get his feet on their neck. In contrast to his tone at the press conference, he ended his opening remarks with the statement, "We've got to find him and kill him." General Wheeler picked up on the president's exhortation with an argument for the expansion of the air campaign and the deployment of ground combat units to Vietnam. Although inter-service disputes had prevented the JCS from generating its own proposal, Wheeler argued that the 12-week bombing program developed under McNamara's guidance was inadequate. It did not make sense militarily to avoid hitting the MiG airfields in North Vietnam. Because the United States was losing the war, the president should approve the JCS recommendation to deploy the remainder of a Marine division, a U.S. Army division, and a South Korean division. Wheeler argued that ground forces would have a major effect on the war, signal American determination and purpose to North Vietnam, serve as a deterrent to escalation, position U.S. military power forward if deterrence failed, and provide bargaining leverage for negotiations. Wheeler pressed the president for a decision, telling him that with three divisions and logistical improvements, your problem is solved. Wheeler, minimizing the cost of his proposal, noted that reserve forces would not have to deploy and could be used to replenish the strategic reserve. Instead of producing a debate on the nature of the problem in Vietnam and examining possible U.S. responses, Wheeler's proposal ran into the president's preoccupation with consensus and his desire to keep American involvement in the war as quiet as possible. The president took a middle course designed to satisfy all parties. Johnson deferred making a decision on Wheeler's three-division recommendation. Instead, he approved the deployment of two additional Marine battalions and expanded the Marine mission from defensive security to offensive counterinsurgency operations. In the long run, the change of mission that committed American troops to offensive combat was more significant than the deployment of additional troops. But the former decision was easier to conceal from the American public in the short term. The president reassured Wheeler that he would consider sending additional forces to Vietnam in the near future, and told him to prepare two American divisions for deployment. After the meeting, Director of Central Intelligence McCone realized that the president had made his decision without an informed, comprehensive estimate of the situation and without considering fully the consequences of expanding the mission of U.S. ground forces in Vietnam. McCone attempted to relate the issue of additional ground forces to the ongoing Rolling Thunder campaign and challenged Taylor's assertion that the tempo of the airstrikes was about right. In a memo to Rusk, McGeorge Bundy, McNamara, and Taylor, McCone argued that the bombing had not been sufficiently heavy and damaging, really, to hurt the North Vietnamese, and had only hardened their attitude. Although Taylor had excised paragraphs of CIA reports that questioned the effectiveness of the airstrikes, McCone's officers in Saigon had forwarded unedited versions of the reports through back-channel communications. McCone argued that the decisions to change the mission of U.S. ground forces in Vietnam to one of active combat was correct only if we hit North Vietnam harder, more frequently, and inflict greater damage. He urged, instead of avoiding the MiGs, we must go in and take them out. A bridge here and there will not do the job. We must strike their airfields, their petroleum resources, power stations, and their military compounds. This, in my opinion, must be done promptly and with minimal restraint. If we are unwilling to take this kind of decision now, we must not take the actions concerning the mission of our ground forces. McCone warned that unless the president made a clear choice between a negotiated settlement and a decisive expansion of the war, the United States would incur an ever-increasing commitment of U.S. personnel without materially improving the chance of victory. The president heard McCone's views in a National Security Council meeting on April 2nd, but he remained resolved to take only the minimal actions necessary to prevent defeat in South Vietnam. McCone had become increasingly frustrated with his limited access to the president, as well as with the administration's apparent disinterest in intelligence. Unlike graduated pressure, McCone's assessment provided no easy solutions to the problem in Vietnam and demanded, in effect, that the president make a difficult choice between commitment to a large-scale war and a negotiated withdrawal. Johnson, however, would not make a tough decision that would alienate constituencies on which his great society depended. 3 weeks after he composed his memo, McCone resigned in frustration. Although he had come to the same conclusion as McCone about what the situation in Vietnam demanded, Wheeler did not consider resignation. He responded to the president's reluctance to commit fully to either negotiation or the use of military force by pressing for a gradual intensification of the war effort, as the president's domestic political concerns permitted. His approach allowed Johnson to avoid deciding whether to go to war in Vietnam, even as the country sank deeper into that war. The president remained more interested in preserving consensus about his policy than in entertaining a wide-ranging discussion on the situation in Vietnam. Taylor's final meeting in Washington revealed that the principal purpose of his visit had been to preserve the superficial harmony and consensus among the president's principal Vietnam advisors. In a meeting with Taylor and the Bundy brothers, Russ told Taylor that the president felt that he must not force the pace too fast or the Congress and the public opinion, which had been held in line up to now through the president's strenuous efforts, would no longer support our actions in Vietnam. Rusk emphasized that Taylor must keep the few decisions that the president did make as quiet as possible. The Secretary of State recognized that Taylor would have to get South Vietnamese permission to deploy the additional Marines, but did not yet want to give up the ability to describe their mission as defensive. Rusk attempted to qualify the president's decision on the mission change by suggesting that the Marines already in country delay offensive operations until the additional battalions join them, and by claiming that any offensive be described as aggressive patrolling. Under no circumstances would Taylor indicate to the South Vietnamese government that the president was considering large-scale American troop deployments. At the end of the meeting, McGeorge Bundy, who had congratulated the president for his personal achievement in presenting his decisions to expand the war within the framework of a continuing policy and a continuing purpose and not as major new departures, stressed to Taylor the need for very tight public information controls on these matters. Taylor indicated that he now understood the situation in the United States. Assured of harmony within his administration, the president moved to diffuse opposition from those who favored an immediate move toward a negotiated settlement. Since first authorizing continuing action against North Vietnam in mid-February, he had ignored and discouraged calls for negotiation. He shared Taylor's view that an early willingness to negotiate would appear to the North Vietnamese as a sign of weakness. Johnson told Ball that early calls for negotiation had him feeling as if he were getting crowded into a corner. Johnson instructed Ball to act as his lawyer and forestall calls for negotiations until North Vietnam had felt the effects of the bombing campaign. In response to peace initiatives from the British Prime Minister, the Secretary General of the UN, and others, the president threatened to get sick and leave town to avoid having to receive their proposals. By the end of March, however, it had become apparent to the president they would have to confront growing public and congressional opposition to his policy. Democratic Senators Mansfield and McGovern had warned him that his policy of expanding the American military effort in Vietnam would have dire consequences. Mansfield argued that U.S. interests on the Southeast Asian mainland did not justify the cost in lives and resources. He urged Johnson to pursue negotiations even if the United States had to accept a less than favorable settlement. Just as he had used tough language to convince the JCS of his determination to commit whatever force was necessary in Vietnam, the president turned to the language of peace to quell opposition to military action. On March 25th, 2 days after receiving Mansfield's memo, and the day after the University of Michigan teach-in, Johnson released a statement that stressed the limited nature of American military actions in Vietnam and cited his readiness to go anywhere at any time and meet with anyone whenever there is promise of progress toward an honorable peace. The president hoped that there would be a time when Southeast Asia would be free from terror, subversion, and assassination, and would be able to reap the benefits of economic and social cooperation with the United States. 1 week later, Averell Harriman sent a memo to McGeorge Bundy, urging the president to develop more fully a proposal for economic development for both Vietnams. Harriman suggested that to regain the support of those who had begun to question the president's Vietnam policy, Johnson offered North Vietnam a political and economic carrot in the form of an exported great society. Bundy, who had come to believe that the president ought to give the American public a more detailed exposition of our conditions for peace and our view of the future in Southeast Asia, began to draft a speech for the president. LBJ chose April 7th to deliver a nationally televised address on Vietnam at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. In that much-publicized speech, Johnson reemphasized his commitment to guarantee the independence of South Vietnam and its freedom from attack, and stressed the continuity between his policy and that of President Eisenhower in the 1950s. He vowed never to be second in the search for a peaceful settlement in Vietnam. While emphasizing his commitment to the use of military force, Johnson held out the promise of a comprehensive economic and public works development program for all of Southeast Asia. He evoked images of progress that, as a New Deal congressman and senator, he had helped bring to his native Texas Hill Country. He promised North Vietnam a Mekong River development program that would provide food and water and power on a scale to dwarf even our own TVA, or Tennessee Valley Authority, and revolutionary advances in medical care, agriculture, and education. Under Johnson's program, North Vietnam could feed its people with food from American warehouses and allow its people to trade in their rags for decent clothing. Johnson's words, as he and his advisors had described them at lunch the day before, were aimed at placating the Sob Sisters and Peace Societies in the United States. The president's stated objective of an independent South Vietnam, securely guaranteed and able to shape its own relationships to all others, free from outside interference, was non-negotiable to North Vietnamese leaders, who remained determined to unite Vietnam under Hanoi's domination. The North Vietnamese Politburo had concluded that negotiations would only be useful to pave the way for a U.S. withdrawal with a lesser loss of face. They planned to negotiate only after the insurrection in the South succeeded. The day after the Johns Hopkins speech, Hanoi responded with 4 points as preconditions for any negotiations. The United States was to withdraw unconditionally from Vietnam. A coalition government in the South, which Hanoi planned to dominate, would be formed to negotiate the unification of Vietnam. Until that government was formed, the Viet Cong's political arm, the National Liberation Front, would be the only legitimate representative of the Vietnamese people. Although it had taken less than 24 hours for Ho to reject LBJ's export version of the Great Society, the response in the United States was generally positive. Former Ambassador to India, economist John Kenneth Galbraith, who had recently returned to the faculty of Harvard University and would become an outspoken critic of the Vietnam War, wrote an open letter to the New York Times. Galbraith praised the president's reversal of what had seemed a military approach to the problem in Vietnam and expressed relief that Johnson was not embarking upon an infantry war in Asia. When Galbraith wrote his letter to the editor, however, U.S. Marines had already received orders to begin offensive killing operations, and two additional Marine infantry battalions, one Marine air squadron, and 20,000 logistical troops capable of supporting three more divisions of combat troops were preparing for deployment to South Vietnam. In pursuit of consensus and not wanting to confront the implications of his decisions, the president had quietly committed the United States to war. The body charged with providing the president with military advice and responsible for strategic planning permitted the president to commit the United States to war without consideration of the likely costs and consequences. Comprehensive estimates of the number of troops necessary to win existed, but to conceal inter-service divisions and to increase the likelihood that the president would approve the actions that they recommended, the Joint Chiefs suppressed them. In late January 1965, Vice Admiral Rufus Taylor, Director of Naval Intelligence, had reported to Admiral MacDonald that the United States should be prepared at an early date to either commit U.S. forces in sufficient strength to ensure victory for our side or get out before it is too late. A JCS study conducted under the direction of the Marine Corps staff estimated that 700,000 troops would be needed to win in Vietnam. Harold Johnson had concluded that it would probably take 5 years and 500,000 men to defeat the insurgency in the South. The failure of early Rolling Thunder strikes came as no surprise to Admiral MacDonald and Harold K. Johnson, but neither had expressed his doubts about the bombing to his civilian superiors. They accepted an open-ended commitment to fight in Vietnam, rather than press for the deployment of the number of troops that they thought would be required to win the war, or develop a strategic plan integrating the air, ground, and naval efforts into a coherent military program. Each member of the JCS continued to suppress his reservations about the strategy of graduated pressure and optimistically advanced his own service's solution to the problem. The chiefs, however, had given the president the military advice he wanted, while excluding the JCS from substantive deliberations. LBJ and McNamara bought the support of the military with a combination of pro forma consultation and promises of stronger action in the future. With Rolling Thunder underway and combat units arriving in South Vietnam, the JCS had begun to press McNamara and Johnson to deliver on their promises. It was time for LBJ to communicate to the JCS precisely what he expected from his military advisors. Chapter 13, The Coach and His Team, April to June, 1965. Maybe we military men were all weak. Maybe we should have stood up and pounded the table. I was part of it, and I'm sort of ashamed of myself, too. At times I wonder, why did I go along with this kind of stuff? Admiral David Lamar MacDonald, 1976. In the spring and summer of 1965, LBJ was responding to political pressures. Having placated the Sob Sisters and Peace Societies with his April 7th Johns Hopkins speech, the president felt compelled to respond to pressure from another quarter, the Joint Chiefs. Indeed, 2 days prior to the president's speech, McNamara asked the JCS for a detailed schedule for the introduction into Vietnam of a force of 2 to 3 divisions at the earliest practicable date. Assuming that the president would soon approve the deployment, the JCS ordered units to prepare for shipment to South Vietnam. Lieutenant General Birkenau, the director of the joint staff, cabled SINCPAC, expressing the JCS's desire to ram logistical units into South Vietnam as rapidly as MACV wants them and we can send them in order to prepare for the support of large ground combat forces. The first confirmed reports that North Vietnamese regular army units had infiltrated into the South added urgency to JCS recommendations for an intensification of the air campaign against the North and for deployment of 3 divisions to South Vietnam. Johnson, however, was unwilling even to entertain the chief's recommendations. He was impressed by the vehemence and strength of the anti-bombing protests and feared that the large-scale troop deployments the chiefs were recommending would raise to a higher level the public and congressional attention directed toward the war. He was still concerned that greater congressional scrutiny on Vietnam meant less attention to the Great Society. He responded to competing pressures with decisions that he hoped would satisfy, or at least placate, critics and potential critics. He refused to consider an intensification of the Rolling Thunder air campaign because it would incite further protests and opposition. He would, however, approve small increases in the level of force in South Vietnam and change the mission of U.S. ground units from defensive to offensive operations, actions, in other words, that he could conceal from the American public and Congress. Units smaller than division size already stationed overseas could be relocated to South Vietnam with less fanfare than the deployment of entire divisions from the United States. Offensive operations could be portrayed as active patrolling in support of what the administration would continue to describe as a primarily defensive operation. The president hoped that his middle course, dependent on lies and obfuscation, would minimize criticism from those opposed to deepening American involvement in the war, as well as those, like the JCS, who urged further action. To continue to hold the middle ground on Vietnam, the president needed the cooperation of the Joint Chiefs. Because he was deceiving the American people and the Congress, keeping the chiefs on the team would become more important to him than it had been previously. The JCS had recognized that graduated pressure was a strategy driven by domestic political objectives. Most of all, the introduction of ground troops to Vietnam was the first natural breakpoint in Johnson's Vietnam policy since graduated pressure had become the administration's strategy in March 1964. The arrival of ground troops in South Vietnam and their employment in offensive operations against the Viet Cong gave the chiefs an opportunity to voice their opposition to Johnson's Vietnam policy. Indeed, the chiefs attempted to press the president to take more resolute action in Southeast Asia. They reached an agreement to tell the president that the immediate deployment of 3 divisions was necessary to win the war in Vietnam. Wheeler asked his colleagues to stand firmly behind this recommendation. The chiefs failed, however, to take advantage of a clear opportunity to question Johnson's policy, and graduated pressure continued to guide the deployment of ground troops while the president's advisors focused on tactical details rather than on strategic issues. From April through June of 1965, the president failed to confront the likely consequences of military actions, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff continued to recommend an escalation of the military effort without presenting a strategy aimed at forcing an outcome consistent with U.S. interests. Johnson's determination to conceal the scale of America's deepening military involvement in Vietnam militated against approving the chief's recommendations. Although he authorized the deployment of 2 additional Marine battalions and 1 air squadron, he was particularly concerned about changing, without the knowledge of Congress, the Marines' mission from defensive to offensive combat operations. In a National Security Action Memorandum issued on April 6th, the President approved a change of mission for all Marine battalions deployed to Vietnam to permit their more active use under conditions to be established and approved by the Secretary of Defense in consultation with the Secretary of State. The final paragraph of the National Security Action Memorandum made clear the President's desire to avoid premature publicity about his recent decisions. Although the actions themselves should be taken as rapidly as practicable, the military should minimize any appearance of sudden changes in policy. Only the Secretaries of Defense and State could issue official statements concerning troop deployments and mission changes. Finally, the National Security Action Memorandum reemphasized that these movements and changes should be understood as being gradual and wholly consistent with existing policy. Meanwhile, because of international and domestic political pressure to stop Rolling Thunder, LBJ assured the American people that he would continue to exercise restraint in connection with the air campaign. Concerned about this issue, Johnson arranged a meeting on April 8, 1965, the day after the Johns Hopkins speech, with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, McNamara, and Deputy Secretary of Defense, Vance. The President was determined to avoid any discussion of the bombing of North Vietnam and made it clear to the Chiefs that he expected results in Vietnam even under the restrictions that he had placed on air and ground operations. The Joint Chiefs, however, based on assessments that Rolling Thunder had not reduced the overall military capability of Vietnamese Communist forces in any major way, continued to recommend lifting the restrictions on the air campaign. Using enlarged photographs, Wheeler recounted recent Rolling Thunder strikes on 2 key bridges in North Vietnam. McConnell noted that U.S. aircraft had dropped 432 bombs on 1 bridge and, although it was damaged, no part of it had been knocked down. 2 American fighters, furthermore, had been shot down by North Vietnamese MiGs. The President asked the chiefs what had gone wrong with the attack. McConnell responded apologetically that neither mission had been well planned or executed. He promised that missions would improve in the future and noted that he had sent to South Vietnam a team of 4 men to get them straightened out. He made no mention, however, of the continued prohibition against targeting the enemy's fighter bases as a possible contributing factor to the fate of the 2 Air Force F-105s. The President said,